Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. On today's show, is it time to break up California? One Silicon Valley entrepreneur is bankrolling an effort to get that question before voters in November, and his plan to split California up into six separate states, Central California being one of them. We'll talk about the pros and cons of that plan with Tim Draper in our program today. Later in the show, we'll talk about why a number of man-made lakes south of Bakersfield are creating controversy during the drought. And we'll get a sneak preview of a brand new project from Fresno area composer Ben Boone and his new CD that mixes jazz and the poems of U.S. Poet Laureate and Fresno resident Philip Levine. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. With two senators taking leaves of absence to deal with legal problems, California Senate Democrats have lost their supermajority. But as Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, the party is downplaying the loss.
Having a super or two-thirds majority cleared the way if Senate Democrats wanted to raise taxes, pass emergency legislation, override gubernatorial vetoes, or place constitutional amendments before voters, all without Republican approval. The loss of Senators Ron Calderon and Rod Wright means the party is now one vote shy of the supermajority. But Democratic consultant Robin Swanson points out the supermajority means less now that the state budget can be passed with a simple majority vote.
Because we have a majority budget passing, I don't think that you're going to see the sort of fights that we've had over the years when it required two-thirds majority to pass a budget in California.
The Senate president has said maintaining a supermajority is important, but maintaining the integrity of the Senate matters more. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
Governor Jerry Brown says he's not sure legalizing marijuana in California is a good idea because the state could lose its competitive edge if too many people are getting high. Brown made his comments yesterday during an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press. When asked whether legalizing marijuana was a good idea or a bad idea for California, Brown said the state already has medical marijuana, which gets very close to what Colorado and Washington have.
I'd really like those two states to show us how it's going to work. The problem with anything, a certain amount is okay, but there is a tendency to go to extremes. And all of a sudden, if there's advertising and legitimacy, how many people can get stoned and still have a great state or a great nation? World's pretty dangerous, very competitive. I think we need to stay alert.
In a wide-ranging interview, Brown also discussed California's drought problems, climate change, and his political career. According to a new report, the federal government shutdown cost communities near Yosemite National Park around $6.7 million in visitor spending. The report issued yesterday by the U.S. Department of Interior also says the national park-related visitor spending dropped by $2.9 million. In 2012, Yosemite had more than 3.8 million visitors who spent $378 million in the park. A list of the best and worst cities to find a job in the U.S. was released yesterday by WalletHub.com. And the results might not be new news to Fresnans. Fresno was ranked third worst out of 60 major U.S. cities. Bakersfield was 33rd on the list, while Los Angeles was the worst. This is Valley Public Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California takes pride in a lot of things. The most populous state, we have beautiful beaches, stunning mountains, some of the nation's most popular national parks. California's farms feed the nation, Hollywood entertains the world, and our technology companies are defining the future. But some say the state is simply too big, too unruly, and too diverse to govern. Our next guest, Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tim Draper, is leading the latest effort to break California up, in this case into six separate states. His team is currently gathering signatures to put the issue before voters later this year. Tim Draper joins us now. Tim, welcome to Valley Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Tim, you're a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur. Why are you wading into a complex issue like this one that can have be a, well, for lack of a better term, a political minefield? Why now?
Well, California used to be the best state in the union for education, and it used to be the best state in the union. We had great infrastructure. We used to have plenty of employment. We used to have a lot of great things going for us. That was 40 or 50 years ago. People are still thinking that that is the California. We are the worst managed state, according to 24/7, of all the states. We are 50th. We spend the most for education, and we are 46th. We spend among the most for prisons, and we have one of the highest recidivism rates. We used to have infrastructure at where infrastructure spending was 26%. Now it's only 3% of our budget. Something's wrong, and I think it's just California's gotten to be too big, too unwieldy, and it is ungovernable. There's some good people who have tried to govern California over these years, but somehow, some way, it is ungovernable. It is, and my belief is that it is just too big. There are too many people with too many different interests, and we have lost touch with our government. And the reason I personally am doing it, I love living here. I love the weather. I love the technology. I love Hollywood. I love the Central Valley. and I want my children and their children and their children to all experience a positive experience as they live in California. With an education system that's 46th in the nation, I'm not comfortable having my children and my children's children here. So I'm looking for a way for us to get out. And the best way to get out, I believe, is to have six Californias to allow us all to be more local to our government, and to make it so that we have a refresh. We have a fresh start. People's initial reaction is, why would you want to break up California? But then when they realize that what you're really doing is creating six new states, and we're giving people a choice now, a choice of states. If they are Californians, they'll have a choice of six states where they can live. And whenever there's a choice, services get improved.
So, Tim, tell us...
And costs go down.
Tell us specifically about your plan and these six states that you're talking about here.
Well, the six states... We've drawn various lines for where the six states would be created, but individual counties also have a choice. They can vote to move into another state, and if that state accepts them, they could be a part of a different state. So, but we've defined states as way up north is Jefferson, where the people of Jefferson are very anxious to break away from California because they are the have-nots of the current regime, and they are saying, we are getting taxation without representation. We want to manage ourselves. We want to govern ourselves. We don't really want to be a part of whatever Californians are telling us what we have to be. The next group is in North California, which would be Sacramento moved all the way across to Marin County. That would be the next state. Then Silicon Valley would be on the West Coast, moving down to about Santa Cruz, and then the Central Valley would be one state, Central California, and then Los Angeles and its surrounding areas would be West California, and then down below that would be South California, where San Diego is. and even the names aren't set in stone. I'm really putting this up there for Californians to create new states, and they can name them whatever they want. They can create their own state bird. They can create their own flags. We're going to be setting up software that allows people to crowdsource the state flag, and then we're encouraging people to work on their constitution through crowdsourcing. All of these constitutions are going to have sort of a standard look to them, but then people are going to be able to change whatever they want about their own constitution.
If you just joined us.
We think this is a great opportunity for Californians to do a restart, to do a refresh of their state, and to allow them to allow us all to live in a better state. If these six states just end up being average states for the U.S., we're all way better off. Because we're 50th. We're the worst state in the union, worst managed state in the union, and we have been for the last 3 years. And people say, well, then it can't get any worse. Well, that isn't true. It can get worse. We'll be 50th, but we'll just keep getting worse. And with that that trend, I really am afraid for our children and our grandchildren.
Tim, you were talking about these states, if they're being average states, if they thus turn out to be the average U.S. state. And I think that's one of the concerns that I'm hearing from people, is that these states wouldn't be equal. They wouldn't be average, at least in terms of their assets and their average incomes. You're going to have a couple of states that are among the poorest in the nation. Central California, Jefferson would be near the bottom of the current 50 states if you look at per capita income. And you would have Silicon Valley and the state of West California that would be incredibly affluent. And how do you get around that issue of this great divide? It's part of the concern that you have about California being ungovernable, and that we're so diverse and folks in Silicon Valley may not have much in common with farm workers in Lamont or Arvin. How do you get around that divide, even with this proposal?
Well, what you're looking at are statistics in the current regime. The current regime is harming Central California. It's harming the people up in North and Jefferson. It is not doing them a good service because they are the have-nots of the current regime. They are actually tend to be the most enthusiastic about having their own state, because then they can they can have a new platform from which they can grow. If you set up a really nice platform for governance, great things can happen. And so I'm thinking that all six of these states are going to be the wealthiest states in the country, all six, because they're going to have new platforms for growth. They're going to be more local to their people, and they're going to be more relevant to their people. And government is us. We the people. We are the government, and we need to take an active role in our own government. That's very hard to do if 38 million people all have one state government.
Again,
so it really needs to be, it's time for us to create six new Californias. It's time for us to create six new states.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tim Draper. He's leading the latest effort to break California up into six new states. Tim, this isn't the first time this idea has been advanced. In fact, the first proposal to break up California dates all the way back to 1859, when the southern part of the state voted to split off. In fact, the whole state voted to split the southern part of the state off from the rest of California. Congress didn't take action on that proposal, and other plans, such as the one advanced by the folks in Jefferson, have fallen on deaf ears over the years. What makes this proposal different this time around?
Well, I think if Californians vote to create six Californias, we are going to be determined to make sure that we get six Californias. And with 38 million people, that's a lot of voters, and that's a lot of influence over the federal government. I'm hoping that momentum rolls all the way through Congress and ends up making it a law. Now, even if it doesn't, during the time after this initiative gets passed, and before the federal government allows us to have six states, we are allowing the counties to choose the states that's right for them, and people will have much more freedom as to where they want to be governed, and so we'll have choice. even before those are states, because there will the way the initiative is written is that the counties that the states will have to compete for the counties, and the counties can self-organize and create more choices for it creates more choices for the counties. It creates more choices for the for Californians.
How do you propose going about breaking up this infrastructure, complex infrastructure that it's taken 165 years to create in some cases? There's a lot of tangled legal webs that go back years and even are contentious today as a whole state, different parts of the state having warring factions over things like water and things. How do you address issues like that moving forward in this new California that's, in essence, balkanized?
Well, the infrastructure in California is falling apart. We have something like 30% leakage in water. They have not applied modern technology to our water system. Our water system, we could have, we can have sensors throughout our water system. We can figure out where those leaks are, and we can plug those leaks. We'll end up with a lot more water. The other thing is that we don't do time division on water. It's only spatially done, and with time division, you can actually end up with more water in the right places at the right times. If we have a big storm, that water isn't captured. We have the worst infrastructure for this. I mean, sure, it's been here for 100 years. It has not been kept up. When we spend 3% on infrastructure, that is not working. And so when six new Californias start, various states will be able to set up whatever infrastructure they want, and if water is the big issue, then water it'll be. If traffic's the big issue, traffic it'll be. Freeways it'll be. So I think by having choice and allowing people to choose which state they want to be a part of, and allowing those states to then be more localized, everybody's going to be better off. And it's going to cost less. California's trying to be all things to all people. And by doing that, they're being nothing for anyone. And it's not working. I can shout from the mountaintop. It is not working. We're 50th. We're the worst state in the union as we are managed, but we can be the great state that we were if we are more local to our government and our government is more relevant to us.
Here's a comment from a listener on Twitter. Jim in Tulare County says, this idea needs to die a quick death, a bad idea in so many ways, end up with two fairly wealthy states and four desperately poor. Tulare, Fresno, Merced area state, Mississippi West, bad idea. What do you see, Tim, as the role or the place for Central California in this new division of states? How can it hold its own with these other more powerful, more glamorous states, perhaps?
Central California feeds the country. In some ways, it feeds the world. They have a lot of influence over the world. Central California has a lot of clout, and in negotiating with the other states, I think they're in a very strong position. I think Central California will do extraordinarily well in having their own state. In the current situation, they are the have-nots. They are the ones that, with our current regime, are constantly battling for water. They take the prisoners of most of the other states, and they can certainly negotiate with other states on that. I think Central California has a great future here. I think that guy is misinformed.
You mentioned a couple of times now the current regime and your dissatisfaction with the way Sacramento is run. And over the past few years, there have been...
It's not just my dissatisfaction. We are 50th. How could we be satisfied? Who's satisfied with 50th? Who's happy that we are the 50th? We are the worst-run state in the nation. Who could be?
And Tim, my point here is that in the past few years when California, the last few years of the last decade when California was dealing with mammoth budget deficits and budget showdowns and the lack of a budget, it took several months to get budgets, and sometimes there was this thread that California is ungovernable. But the current narrative seems to be that California is on a comeback, that the budget situation has improved. Certainly there are a lot of problems. You've mentioned the current 3 years. Is this a political dissatisfaction with Governor Brown that's driving this? You didn't mention the past 5 years or the past 10 years. Is this a partisan issue in your view?
No, no. I actually used to be a Republican, and then I was sort of a Democrat, and then I just decided that I was not declared because I believe that the two parties are two sides of the same coin. We need to do something about that too. But from your earlier point, I mean, this has nothing to do with Governor Brown. He's great. He's doing great things, but he can't. It's not doable. And just because I said the last 3 years, I think that's as long as they have data for. But I think before that, I don't know whether there was data. This is just I'm just reading from the data. The data says that California, for the last 3 years running, is the worst governed state in the world.
Well,
in the country.
Yeah, well, certainly
maybe not in the world.
Certainly going to be interesting to see how this plays out, and it will be something that we certainly are watching here in Central California and across the state. Again, our guest today on Valley Edition has been Tim Draper. He is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who is leading the effort to put an issue before voters in November to split California into six states. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and talk some more about what's going on in California with the drought, and also find out what's going on with those lakes south of Bakersfield. Stephen Mayer from Bakersfield, California, will join us here on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Hundreds of millions of dollars are set to flow for emergency drought relief in California. This past weekend, Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a package of bills that will fund water projects and provide immediate assistance to the driest parts of the state. From Sacramento, reporters Katie Orr and Amy Quinton have the story.
The drought relief bills made their way swiftly through the California legislature, arriving on the floors of the Assembly and Senate just a week after they were announced by Governor Jerry Brown and legislative leaders. During the floor debate, Senator Mark Leno acknowledged the $687 million package can't actually change the weather.
Colleagues, if this bill could mandate that we have rain and snow every day for the next 60 days, it would do so. But unfortunately, it cannot. As has been mentioned, this is a first step, depending upon how much more precipitation we'll get before the end of the wet season. We may be back, because there will be additional need.
Republicans in both chambers mostly joined Democrats in voting for the drought relief legislation, which will provide immediate funding for emergency drinking water supplies and food assistance. Grants will also be accelerated for water storage, conservation, and recycling projects. But the GOP criticized the bills for not going far enough.
They're really putting a Band-Aid on a shark bite.
Central Valley Senator Tom Berryhill says much more needs to be done.
They do nothing to address the immediate need for additional water storage. They do nothing to help people get back to work. And if it started raining for the next month, my guys down in Fresno are still going to get a zero water allocation. So this is a lost season for those folks, no matter what happens.
At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
I'm Amy Quinton. The drought relief package would provide $25 million to help community food banks, primarily in regions heavily dependent on agriculture. Food banks in the San Joaquin Valley are anticipating a huge increase in need from thousands of jobless farm workers. The Fresno Community Food Bank normally serves about 5,800 people on the western side of the county. During the last drought in 2009, CEO Andy Souza says the numbers of people they served increased dramatically.
We were serving between 14 and 18,000 people a month. But at that same period of time, we still had about a 25% water allocation. And so there were less acres that were taken out of production.
Souza says now that farmers in the area are getting no water and expect to leave more land fallow, the number of jobless workers in need of food could swell as high as 25,000. Jeff Michael is with the Business Forecasting Center at the University of the Pacific. He says 6,000 agricultural-related jobs were lost in the last drought, but adds the state was also in the depths of a historic recession in 2009. Still, he doesn't doubt that this year will be worse.
The impacts could make their way into somewhat higher-value crops than in 2009. So we should see higher loss of employment related to agriculture, probably in excess of 10,000 jobs this year.
Fresno Community Food Bank has another concern with this year's drought. Again, Andy Souza.
The area that is going to be impacted here in West Fresno County is an area that we get a lot of fresh produce directly donated to the food bank during the course of the year.
About 1.7 million pounds of produce, to be exact. Souza says the drought relief package will help the food bank purchase food from elsewhere. He says during the last drought, relief came late. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Through the first 2 months of 2014, enrollment in California's health benefit exchange, Covered California, continues to pick up. But as Kenny Goldberg from California Healthline reports, enrollment among Latinos, especially in the online exchange, remains low.
As executive director of neighborhood healthcare, Tracy Ream oversees 10 community clinics in San Diego and Riverside counties. Over the past year, clinic employees have tried to raise awareness about Covered California at more than three dozen Latino-focused events. And Neighborhood Healthcare has deployed 15 certified enrollment counselors to help people enroll. And all of those counselors speak Spanish. Reem says that even though Latinos have been targeted in a statewide media campaign, her counselors still have had to start with most clients at square one.
People need to even learn that they might be eligible for insurance. They have no idea. They never heard of it.
Reem says the counselors have had to spend up to 3 hours with some Spanish speakers.
Because there's so many pieces of it that they have to learn about and make decisions about.
Statewide, an estimated 1.2 million Latinos are eligible for subsidies to help lower their costs. But so far, only about 74,000 Latinos have signed up for coverage. There likely are a number of reasons for the dearth in Latino enrollment. For one thing, Covered California didn't post an online Spanish language enrollment form until early January, more than 3 months after it opened for business. And even though about 60% of the state's certified enrollment counselors speak Spanish, only about 10% of the exchange call center operators do. What's more, says State Senator Norma Torres, Covered California's website is just not user-friendly for Spanish speakers.
They need the website to work. They need the hotline to work. They need a counselor to answer the call. When they want to refer a friend, because they know how important it is to have health care, they can't refer a friend because the button goes right back to English on the website.
Covered California spokeswoman Liselda Lopez admits the website hasn't been operating on all cylinders. She also concedes that consumers who call often have to wait a long time to talk to someone.
We have a heavy lift. We are working very hard to resolve this quickly and to make sure that everybody that should be benefiting from Covered California is coming through our doors.
But even if the website and call centers were functioning perfectly, there would still be some cultural issues to consider. Gregory Talavera is a physician and professor in San Diego State University's Graduate School of Public Health. Talavera says Spanish-speaking Latinos, many of whom are immigrants, tend to be unfamiliar with the concept of private sector health insurance.
Many Latinos who come to the United States come from countries where the purchase of insurance is not based on individual choice or selection. They either are uninsured and seek care on an episodic basis, or they were insured through their government employer.
Talavera says families of Latinos who have yet to apply for full citizenship have another concern.
There is a perception within the community that by utilizing public services such as health care and other social service benefits, that it could somehow affect their application in the future.
Covered California's Lopez agrees that there are cultural factors affecting Latino enrollment. That's why the exchange continues to emphasize the importance of community outreach to get its message across. In addition, the exchange is targeting Latinos in its multi-million dollar marketing campaign through Spanish language television ads and direct mail. The exchange is also active on Facebook and Twitter. Initially, their marketing sought to build awareness of Covered California. Lately, it's trying to educate Latinos about some of the nuts and bolts of health insurance.
They have a lot of questions, and so it takes a little bit more effort to enroll a Latino family than it would somebody else. And we appreciate that. We want to make it work. And so we're giving them the basic information like what's a deductible, what is a copay, what does this mean?
Tracy Ream says at California's community clinics, the point of entry for many Latinos, it's all about word of mouth.
So if you have a patient come in, and they're happy with the service, they definitely talk to their neighbor. And I think that's what's going to happen with Covered California. So it's just going to take time.
That report comes to us from Kenny Goldberg, a reporter with California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation. California's drought has communities up and down the valley looking to conserve water. The city of Orange Cove has already banned outdoor watering this year, and later tonight, Lemoore City Council will hold a meeting to discuss ways the city can reduce residents' water use by as much as 25%. The drought has also sparked a lot of questions from people, like what's the best way to cut water use at home? In Bakersfield, one reader of the Bakersfield Californian posed just such a question to staff reporter Stephen Mayer. What's the story behind the numerous long and narrow man-made lakes that dot the landscape of the Central Valley southeast of the city of Bakersfield? Stephen Mayer joins us now on Valley Edition to talk about what he found. Stephen, welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the geography of these lakes and exactly where they are, can you paint a picture of exactly what we're talking about here before we talk about the specifics?
Sure. There are various groups of lakes. The one that I visited is directly south of Lamont by a few miles off of Wheeler Ridge Road, north of Bear Mountain Boulevard, which runs, if you headed east, you would head into the city of Arvin. And another grouping of lakes is located closer to Arvin proper, south of the city, near a local golf course. There may be others as well, by the way. I believe there are. Some have been described to me as being west of town, and I think there might even be some near the Kern River. So I don't have a hard and fast figure of exactly how many lakes are out there, but it's surely more than a dozen.
Now, there are a number of residential communities throughout the valley that are built along man-made lakes. These are a little different, though, in that they're very long and relatively narrow. Exactly what's the idea behind these developments, and where are they, what's around them? As I understand, they're really in rural areas.
The ones I visited, at least on the outside, I didn't actually get through the gates, are, you know, the ones that are south of Lamont are definitely located in the middle of farmland. Right across the street is a grape vineyard, and there are various crops being grown around them. And they tend to be gated communities. You have to be able to have a code to get through the gate. And some of the lakes are more than a half mile long. I think some are shorter than that and fairly narrow, but maybe a couple of hundred to 500 feet wide. And I understand fairly shallow, 6-7 feet, built specifically for water skiing. Some of the lakes, for instance, have ramps built into the middle of them so that people can go up ramps and practice that. And some of the lakes also have attracted events that are, you know, ski events, nationals, and other sorts of events that are, at least for people who are into water skiing, pretty big time, I guess.
Now, again, I should point out, you can read Stephen Mayer's article about this in Monday's Bakersfield Californian. Now, Stephen, what is the concern that you're hearing about these lakes? I hear some people talking about the use of a scarce resource, water, in this time. And what are you hearing specifically about these developments? Was there an openness to talk about this?
Well, one man I reached who is a resident of one of the lakes was quite reticent about speaking and talked about not attracting attention to the lakes and that sort of thing. A water manager from a local water district did express some concerns. It certainly was not a condemnation of the concept of these lakes. More of I think his attitude was it should be part of the conversation as we're dealing with this really historic drought. And as we allow new developments, should water availability be maybe a little bit more, upfront as far as whether developments are allowed or not? And certainly since there are so many of these, one does wonder what is the cumulative water use. However, I did receive a letter by a guy who also lives at one of these lakes, and it was very detailed and also very civil, I might add. And he provided some history. He said that the lakes to the south of Lamont, for example, were part of a natural wetland area because creeks led water to that area, and at least during wet years, ponds were developed. But as ag moved in, the creeks were either minimized or completely plowed over, and the ponds eventually disappeared, but later appeared as these ski lakes.
Interesting. Well, one could almost say that about large portions of the valley, including Colonel Baker's Field, the lake that used to sit adjacent there.
That is correct.
Do we know where the water is coming from for these lakes?
The ones south of Lamont are coming from groundwater, so they have their own wells, and they draw water from the wells to fill the lakes, and then as evaporation occurs, to refill or top them off. And there may be some that are connected to some sort of a, you know, water district, but I think that most, if not all, are simply, they have their own well, they draw the water as needed, just like a neighboring farmer might. Unfortunately, it appears that the water table is dropping in that area. The man I spoke with who talked to me about this for the story said that the water table dropped recently 70 feet and they had to push their pumps down lower to get that water. So, you know, not to say they're to blame. Certainly local growers are also drawing plenty of water, but it is a question. An aquifer doesn't have property lines. So just because you're pulling it up to your property doesn't mean it's not affecting those who are adjacent to you.
And that's one of the hottest issues that people are talking about now in the midst of this drought, and that for many years has been something of the third rail of California water politics, and that's regulating groundwater. California has this idea of something called beneficial use, but I even hear some in the ag community saying maybe it's time to look at least local regulations about what someone can pump out of the ground, because there's sorts of issues in regards to neighbors and having access to that aquifer. Is there any idea of the planning process that went into this from Kern County and what maybe the long-term viability of something like this could be, especially given our water woes here in Central Valley?
Yeah, my story did not get that deep into that question. And in the letter that I received that I mentioned earlier, the gentleman who lives at one of these said that the one he is on has been there for some 30 years, and that most of the lakes have been around for at least 15 or nearly 15. So apparently these are not recent developments. I think our attention is drawn to them due to the drought.
Stephen, in reading your article, it seems that the people who live in these lakes kind of like to keep them on the down low, as they say. There's not a lot of people who know about the existence of these lakes south of the city. What do you think that means, and who exactly lives there? I understand there's a private airstrip at one of them as well.
More than one. I think several have private airstrips. And many of those who have houses or other sorts of amenities at the lakes do live outside the area, Southern California, for example. In fact, the gentleman who sent the letter that I referenced earlier said he lives about 100 miles away. Others are more local. They live right there. Or maybe it's a second home and they live in the Bakersfield area. But, There was a sense I got from the gentleman I spoke with for the story, who said that he didn't want any, he used the term looky-loos coming out as a result of my story, and seemed to suggest that it would bring them unwanted attention. So that's kind of, that was the sense I got from him. But the gentleman who sent the letter today said, no, that's not their attitude at all. They're much more open. The reason that they're gated communities, he said, is because of, you obviously, if you have a body of water, you cannot have it open, and there's certainly liability issues involved. So you've got to have a controlled access to those sorts of things. But I'm sure some folks probably want their privacy. Some folks maybe are not really happy about having a light shined on them, while others may be more open.
Certainly, it's an interesting topic, and one not just related to Kern County, but throughout the valley. The future of our sustainable developments and agriculture and things like lakefront communities, those are things that all of our listeners throughout the valley can think about and will be thinking about in this dry season. Again, we've been talking with Stephen Mayer, staff reporter with the Bakersfield Californian. You can read his piece about these often overlooked finger-like lakes that dot the landscape south of the city of Bakersfield. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joe. I enjoyed it.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk to Fresno composer and jazz artist Benjamin Boone and find out more about his new project, which includes the poems of Philip Levine and some upcoming performances at Fresno's Rogue Festival. That's all coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week on our program, we told you about Fresno's Rogue Performance Festival that is taking place currently in Fresno's Tower District. This week, we revisit the festival and bring in a special guest. We hear his music in the background there, and he's joining us right now, Fresno composer and musician, jazz artist, saxophonist, multi-instrumentalist, Benjamin Boone, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Joe. It's really a pleasure to be here today.
Ben, you have a very interesting project that is in the works right now. You just had a performance with this new ensemble this past weekend, and it's very significant, not just to Fresno jazz audiences, but also to Fresno poetry fans, because you are combining your music, your original jazz compositions, with the poems of U.S. Poet Laureate and Pulitzer Prize winner Philip Levine. This has to be a dream come true for you to work with one of the greatest poets of all time here in America.
Yeah, I have to say, Joe, it's one of the projects that I'm most proud of. It's been a real joy to work with Philip and work with the area musicians and garnering some guest artists to be a part of this project. I love the spoken word. I love dealing with poetry. My brother is a professor of English at USC, and I think he's instilled a love of words in me. And it's just been a true joy to work on this project.
We're going to listen to some selections from this new project, which you're working on a CD in a little bit. But I want to ask you, how did this come about? Because Phil is sort of the dean, in addition to being poet laureate and the Pulitzer Prize winner. He's sort of the dean of Fresno poets, founded the school of Fresno poets and brought together so many great talents through his creative writing program at Fresno State. How did you go about connecting with him? Because he's been a big jazz fan for years.
Yes, he has. And you know, there's an interesting backstory to this. When I was offered the job at Fresno State in 2000, I spoke with one of my writer friends in Tennessee, Danny Foltzgray, and I told him about the job offer, and I was asking him if he knew about the school. And he said, well, gosh, my favorite poet works there, Philip Levine. And if they have Philip Levine, it has to be a really good place, so you should take that job, Ben. So I really have wanted to work with Philip since I arrived in 2000, but it didn't manifest until the Fresno Filmworks had a fundraiser, I guess a year and a half ago, at the Tower Theater, and they invited Peter Everwine, Philip, and me to be a part of that. And I asked Philip if we could collaborate on some tunes. And so he agreed, and we collaborated, and it was well received. And so after that, I just simply asked him if he'd like to continue the project and continue the collaboration. And he very graciously said that he would. And so we started recording a few tracks, and they turned out pretty good. And so we just continued the process. So now we have, I think, 26 of his poems set to music.
And you performed with Philip this past weekend at the Rogue Festival, and you have some upcoming performances without Philip Levine coming up this coming weekend, Friday night and then Saturday night at the Severance Building on North Wishon Avenue. What was the recording process like going into the studio? You're jazz musicians. You kind of know what you do when you get into the recording studio. What was it like bringing in a spoken word artist, especially one as internationally famous as Philip Levine?
Well, it was really exciting and also somewhat terrifying because what I needed to do in figuring out what compositions to use and how to integrate word in music, I really had to think about making space for the words to be heard. And so some of the tunes were fully composed, like the little trailer that you played coming into this is from a poem called Our Valley. And that's entirely composed. And then there's another track I think you might play later called Jin, and that's completely improvised. And that's the very first time that we did it, first time we heard Philip reading it. We just had Philip tell us a little bit about what he thought about the poem, and then we just the musicians just responded to that. And so what's captured is that very moment, that very first time the musicians and Philip were together. And I think there's a magic that happens when people are interacting musically for the first time. And another thing I'd like to say about interacting with Philip in the studio is that, you know, he's been a jazz fan for a really long time. He has a poem about Clifford Brown that actually Terrence Blanchard's going to play. He's recording it this week, and that'll be on the project. There's a poem about John Coltrane. Branford Marcellus has agreed to be on that track. And so he has this love of jazz music and this knowledge of jazz music. So when he read his poems with the musicians in the studio, you know, he was in tempo and he was in the key and he was grooving with the musicians, and the musicians were feeding off of the energy that he gave. He just exuded this enthusiasm for what we were doing and for the music. And so there was a synergy that happened that I hope comes across in the tracks that you're playing.
Let's go ahead and listen to Our Valley. This is an excerpt from one of your pieces that's on this forthcoming CD. Again, Benjamin Boone's Quartet with Pulitzer Prize winner, U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine.
Our Valley. We don't see the ocean. Not ever. But in July and August, when the worst heat seems to rise from the hard clay of this valley, you could be walking through a fig orchard when suddenly the wind cools, and for a moment you get a whiff of salt, and in that moment, you can almost believe something is waiting beyond the Pacheco Pass. Something massive, irrational, and so powerful, even the mountains that rise east of here have no word for it. You probably think I'm nuts, saying the mountains have no word for ocean. But if you live here, you begin to believe they know everything. They maintain that huge silence we think of as divine. A silence that grows in autumn when snow falls slowly between the pines. And the wind dies to less than a whisper. And you can barely catch your breath because you're thrilled and terrified.
Again, Benjamin Boone and his quartet with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, U.S. Poet Laureate, and Fresno resident Philip Levine. Wow, that is just amazing. It has to be electric to be in the studio in a moment like that and hearing this all unfold in your headphones and in the studio.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the last line of that segment was thrilled and terrified were the words that Philip used in the poem. And I think that sums up, the feeling. I should mention who the musicians were on that,
do.
If you don't mind.
Yes, please.
Because we use various musicians on various tracks. That was Nye Morton on the bass, Gary Newmark on drums, David Alse on keyboards, Philip Reading, obviously. I was playing soprano saxophone. And the violin you heard at the beginning is my collaborator over in Germany, Stefan Putsch. So he actually recorded that separately and sent it over, and then we integrated the violin into that. But I love that poem about the valley. It really captures the feeling in the sense of you get when you're entering the valley from the Pacheco Pass.
How did you come about writing the pieces that you did write that you weren't improvised?
Uh-huh.
Did you read the poem and think about it and mull it over and then work on things that way? Or did you already have things written and, oh, this might work well with this poem?
Right. Well, actually, both of those. In the case of Our Valley, I read the poem over and over, and what I got from that from the poem was a sense of space and a sense of landscape and a sense of vastness. And so, after thinking about it, I went to the piano and tried out a ton of things, and I ended up coming up with that repetitive type of figure that you hear in the bass and the piano at the very beginning. And I wanted and think the violin and saxophone with the echoes and stuff give a sense of vastness and of space and majesty and all of those. So that one was really came at, well, with all of them, I read the poem over and over and over again, asked my poet friends, what they thought the poems meant, and then sweated out the music I thought would be appropriate.
Yeah, let's go ahead and now listen to another track. This is the one that you were talking about.
This
was improvised on
yeah.
the spot. Again, Philip Levine with the Benjamin Boone Quartet.
Chin. The first time I drank gin, I thought it must be hair tonic. My brother swiped the bottle from a guy whose father owned a drugstore that sold booze in those ancient, honorable days when we acknowledged the stuff was a drug. Three of us passed the bottle around, each tasting with disbelief. People paid for this? People had to have it the way we had to have the women we never got near? Actually, they were girls. But never mind, the important fact was their impenetrability. Leo, the third foolish partner, suggested my brother should have swiped Canadian whiskey or brandy. But Eddie defended his choice on the grounds of the expressions gin house and gin lane, both of which indicated the preeminence of gin in the world of drinking, a world we were entering without understanding how difficult exit might be.
Again, Benjamin Boone and his quartet, an excerpt from a forthcoming CD featuring the poems of Philip Levine, Pulitzer Prize winner and U.S. Poet Laureate, and longtime Fresno resident Benjamin Boone joins us on our program today. Ben, we just have a few minutes left. Has to be not only a thrill to perform with these musicians and to perform with Philip Levine as you did this past weekend, but also to put this project together and see it to fruition. When can we expect to maybe see this out in public on compact disc?
Yeah, I'm hoping before the end of the year, but we'll have to see all the business arrangements and everything with that. And really quickly, Craig Von Berg was on the last track, Spee Kozloff, Karen Margoth, Brian Hamada, and of course, Philip reading the poem. And Karen, during the recording of this, was laughing so absolutely hysterically that, anyway, that's a funny backstory. She thought it was really a funny poem.
Oh, great stuff. That's what you get. You never know what'll happen when you go into the studio with musicians. Now, you're going to be performing this weekend, Friday night at 10, and then Saturday night at 10 with your group, the Evolution Quartet, as part of the Rogue Festival. Tell us briefly about that.
Absolutely. We're going to be doing some of the tunes that are going to be on the CD without Philip. We did perform with Philip last weekend, but not this weekend. David Alce is on the keyboard, Spee Kozloff on the bass, Brian Hamada drums, and we have a special guest, Mike Taylor, playing one of Spee's tunes. And I should also mention some of David Alce's compositions are on the CD with Philip, too. So David's a fabulous composer, and it's just a joy to work with such great musicians and musicians.
We'll definitely be looking forward to that, and also looking forward to your behind the music performance that's coming up this weekend with the Fresno Philharmonic.
Oh, thanks so much, Joe. It's been a real pleasure to do the Inside the Music pre-concert talks for the Fresno Philharmonic. They come 1 hour before each of the Masterworks concerts. There are links to some videos I've done with guest artists, and you're going to be filling in with me for the Woo Man concert when I'm at a conference.
That's
so
the rumor
I appreciate
that's out
that.
There. Pinch hitter here behind the microphone. Looking forward to it. And again, Benjamin Boone, thank you so much. If people want more information, do you have a website or anything like that?
I do. It's benjaminboone.com, or I'm on Facebook too. So wonderful if you can come out to the Rogue Festival. The last concert, 10 o'clock on Saturday, is going to go into an after party and a jam session. So a lot of local musicians, if you want to come and play, come on down.
Well, we look forward to it, and we're looking forward to that CD when it comes out later this year again. Benjamin Boone, our guest today on Valley Edition. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, production and operations manager Don Weaver, audio engineer Marv Allen, I'm Joe Moore. We'll see you again next week. And remember, you can follow us on Twitter at KVPR and send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.